Good morning, everybody. That's better. Thank you, everybody, for coming along this morning. Gives me great pleasure to introduce Ian Silk. Ian's the Chief Executive of Australian Super, which is one of Australia's, it's probably by some measures the biggest. Superannuation fund. So, and Ian's been at the helm of that fund for quite some time now. So I think we'll all benefit from hearing from him this morning. Session will be after a brief presentation, reasonably interactive, so we'll be certainly canvassing the room, looking around for plenty of questions, but it's good roll-up, and I can see there's plenty of people who operate in the group insurance space in particular who are here, and so I'm sure ready to lap up some learnings from the client perspective this morning. Ian's a member of the Financial Services Advisory Council to the Federal Treasurer, a member of the Australian Financial Literacy Board, the Government's Financial Literacy Board, and a director on the Eurela Board. He's worked in the finance industry for 17 years, and prior to this he held a range of senior positions with the Victorian Government. So very well equipped for quite an interesting session this morning. Without further ado, over to you, Ian.
Thanks, Andrew, and thanks for attending today. I was wondering how many people might turn up for this session when I saw it was described in the session title in the program was One Small Step for Man and Woman, the Quest for a Member-Focused Insurance Policy, which I've got nobody to blame because that was my idea for the title. But when I read it in the program, I thought, geez, this is rather pretentious. I wonder how many people will actually turn up. So I'm pleased that you've come despite the title. Okay, so Meredith has asked me to give you a case study on the Australian Super, the recent group insurance tender for Australian Super. So I'm not pretending that what was relevant for us is necessarily relevant for other clients, but I think there were certainly some interesting learnings through the process for us, and I think for the insurers that participated, and hopefully there'll be some interesting insights through this process for you. Before I get into the detail of what happened, I want to give you a little bit of background. So Australian Super was established nearly 4 years ago now, and the idea behind that was to bring together three elements in a way that we thought was probably unique in the Australian superannuation landscape. So one was to be a profit for member fund. The second was to exhibit the sort of commercial rigour and commercial focus which is often but not universally seen in that sector. And thirdly, to bring an element of scale that doesn't apply elsewhere in the sector. So for those three factors to operate in combination, as I said, in what I think is a unique package. And we particularly, so 4 years down the track, I think we've been pretty successful in some areas in applying those elements, and a number of elements are work in progress. But it was that combination of thinking that very much bore on how we approached the approach to this group insurance tender. So we had four ideas that framed our approach when we started to plan for it. This was a long time in the planning. We knew this was going to be a big effort. We really wanted to make a mark for our members with changing insurance. The first was our view that the overall offering of group insurers in Australia through directly or through the employers or through super funds was frankly pretty average. Not just a comment on our insurer, but across the board, that was our view. It was pretty average from a consumer's point of view. Second observation, in light of the first, is slightly odd. We thought there was a pretty strong market amongst the insurers themselves. Good depth in the market, strong level of competition, notwithstanding the first point. The third point was that we thought that amongst that strong market, there was likely to be a pretty good appetite for the sort of change that we had in mind, significant change. And the fourth point was we were going to have a real lash at it. So we had significant time and resources. We had Greg Staunton, who joined us from IOFS Insurance Broking, Noel Lacey, known to many people in this room, and Jeff Humphreys, who did a lot of work for us through this process. We had those resources. We did an international study trip, those people to the US and UK, and we came back and really tried to take a fresh approach to what those three factors in combination could do. So I'll shortly go through the process and some of the issues we learned, but I think most of you know, but for the record, Cominsure had been the fund's insurer for best part of a decade, and this process saw us engaging Tower to replace Cominsure. We wouldn't have had the relationship with Cominsure for a decade if it had not been a good one, and so we had then and continue to have a high opinion of Cominsure, notwithstanding our decision to engage Tower. I like those things that are important information that never last for more than a second on these screens. So today I want to go through what we did to confirm our view of the member experience. As I said, we wanted to make real change, and we thought we've got the capacity to do it. If we can't do it, there's something wrong in this market, and it's our view that we have effected significant change. Significant change here, of course, for a fund like ours, manifests itself only in one material way, and that is, are there better benefits for members? And we think there are. And I think all of the insurers that participated in the process got some benefit from it, without sort of trying to be too patronising about it. And I'll articulate some of the things that I think they probably got out of it. In terms of the benefits for members, in a fund like ours, and Hazel spoke about, what was it a term, really nice term, benign, what was the term she used in there? Benign neglect, yeah, which is sort of a catch-all phrase to cover all the sins of ignorance, omission, apathy and all the rest of it. In a fund like ours, relatively low account balance, relatively low engagement, certainly low engagement with insurance, more than 90% of our members cop whatever we provide by way of the default arrangement, more than 90%. So that is always the big issue for us. What's our default investment setting and what's our default insurance setting? So in this case, we're all about structuring the best default setting, structuring the best alternatives for those people who didn't want the default setting, and a number of other issues which I'll come to. So, crudely put, this is the sort of model that we had in mind. We want to look at the relationships between the direct parties involved in the provision of the insurance. Secondly, the pricing. Thirdly, the design. And we had a particular focus on service. I want to come back to that because it probably hasn't had the focus from a trustee point of view, at least, that it might have. So our very high-level view is that the current arrangements, the relationship doesn't work as well as it might be because there are three organisations that have a significant degree of interaction with the member: the trustee, the administrator and the insurer. We wanted to move to a situation where there were no more than two levels of interaction and there was one primary one. And so the primary one is with what we've called here the administrator-insurer. So there was one party that was dealing with the member rather than the typical handoff that you get, which leads to inefficiencies and great delays and frustrations for a lot of members. Pricing, we didn't think pricing was too bad in the industry across the board, but we thought the scale that we had was not appropriately reflected in the pricing, and we were keen to pursue that. Generally rudimentary design. I think design in group offerings has become significantly more sophisticated in the last decade or so, but still it's at a pretty rudimentary level. So we wanted to review the default settings, not increase them across the board, but increase them for most people, but decrease them for some, so an element of tailoring there. Provide much greater flexibility for those people for whom the default option was not what they were after, and a range of options. And service, I've got some statistics which I'll come to shortly, but service in this industry from a consumer point of view is lamentable. We're all part of the industry, and I think we've just come to accept a level of service as, well, that's what it is. And no real critical scrutiny as to whether it's good, bad or indifferent. Frankly, it's bloody hopeless. if you're a, and I'm talking about for Australian Super members as much as anybody else, if you're a disability claimant, the delays that you experience are appalling. And frankly, I can't understand why there's not greater community outrage. And it's a poor reflection on all of us that we've allowed it to get to this point. So a little about Australian Super. So we're a multi-industry fund, but what makes insurance design especially difficult for us is that we're a multi-everything. We're multi-industry, multi-occupation, multi-income. We've got, you name an ethnicity, an ethnic background, we've got it. We're broadly 50-50 gender-wise and so on. So unlike some industry funds like CBUS or HESTA at the other end of the spectrum, there's not a typical Australian Super member, which makes design issues a bit more complex than is the case in a single industry fund. So we did a lot of research. We did a lot of research of our own membership. We participated in an AIST Industry Fund Forum survey. We did the US-UK research. We did a lot of research into actually what happened with claims in particular and applications for increased cover. So we had some broad stats, and we really burrowed into that, spoke to members what their experience was. And as I said, we were pretty keen to exploit our scale. So the AIST Industry Fund Forum research was quite revealing. It showed that, and the figures for Australian Super's membership were almost identical to the broader research, which covered about 2,400 people and members of nine funds. So two-thirds of people had no insurance outside of Super. Frankly, to me, the more surprising figure is that about a third of them had made a conscious decision about that. But TPD for us was particularly problematic. How do you decide a 30-year-old is going to be unable to work again with medical advances and all the other variables around? It's a big call. If you can avoid telling a person that they're never going to work again, then you want to avoid it. You don't want to hide the truth from them, but if there's scope for that not to be the reality, how debilitating, how depressing would it be to be told that you're never going to work again? So we had a number of elements around this that we wanted to factor into the design. One of the issues was, how should TPD be paid? And interestingly, about two-thirds of people said they wanted a combination, not just the model that we had provided of lump sum and not just income protection insurance. Now, bearing in mind that the research also demonstrated that only about 1% of people would opt into income protection insurance. And here we have two-thirds of people saying when they give it consideration, they'd like it paid in a particular way, and a substantial proportion of people saying they'd prefer to have it provided, albeit only 1% had chosen to have it, which gets back to the Hazel's term before. The review also threw up a number of other lessons. In particular, there was a tolerance for higher cost. So we ended up with a default setting, default costings of around $2.50 to around $7.50, depending on the person's age and the type of occupation they're in, off a backdrop of about $3 as the default setting. So there was this higher tolerance on the one hand, but still a trade-off that the trustees, frankly, took more note of than many of the members in the member research. Every dollar you take out of a person's retirement savings to pay for insurance cover is, of course, a dollar that they're not going to have compounding for their retirement savings. And, of course, there are different views about this. Nick Sherry, the lunch speaker, is a well-known, opponent. That's probably putting it too high. But he had serious reservations about the extent to which insurance premiums are denuding people's retirement savings. That was an issue that bore very strongly in the minds of our trustees, because we've got 1.5 million members, and they span people that have got next to nothing in the way of retirement savings to people that have got many millions of dollars. But the the bulk of our members by number are low to middle income earners. Very large number of part-time casual workers and full-time workers who don't earn much income. So on the one hand, they're especially vulnerable to periods out of the workforce due to injury or incapacity because they don't have much savings. On the other hand, they should have their retirement savings working as hard as they can so that they can grow to as large an amount as possible when they retire. So the member experience, the important figures are not just the industry average, this being the average claim assessment delay times, but the note. So this is from the date of claim documentation being lodged with the insurer, final documentation being lodged with the insurer. And as people here are experienced in this area know, that can be months, months and months. So the clock doesn't start ticking until the process has actually been going for a very long period of time. And then when you come to death benefits, like we all know, the protracted process, process built upon process, built upon process to ensure a fair outcome. Well, heaven help you if you're really relying on that fair outcome and you need the money quickly. So this research showed up these funds. And if you look at the proportion of people who go through underwriting and then do not proceed. Now, I'm somewhat embarrassed to say that Fund C is well, was Australian Super. So we had a process that one in four people dropped out of because the process was too damn hard. They'd expressed a very clear intention to change their insurance cover, almost always to increase it, and the process we had, and this is not a knock on CommInsure, this is a knock on us, was so complex, so convoluted, that they gave up. So what did this whole tender process end in? Well, it ended in significant price improvements, somewhere between 8 and 33% improvements in death cover, a death and TPD cover, and somewhere between 1 and 51% increase in insurance, income protection insurance benefits. But for me, and so they're material improvements, obviously. But for me, it was the service changes that hopefully are going to provide the longest lasting, most enduring and most significant benefits for members. So we have significantly reduced, and I say we've significantly reduced, this doesn't start till the 29th of May, but we have agreed with Tower significant improvements in the time taken to manage underwriting and the time taken to deal with claims. We've introduced a whole lot of tools and mechanisms, including telelodgement, which we introduced under CommInsure's watch nearly 18 months ago, which has had a great effect, great improvement in the processing time. And we've got a whole lot of online tools and support for members that are looking to either pursue their claim, find out where they are in the process, or at the other end, when they're looking to review their cover, assess how much insurance they might need. Design has, what we sought to do was to align the fund's insurance offering with the needs of members. Now, as I said before, we're like a snapshot of the workforce. So how does one fund do that? Very big ask. So what we did was to improve the default. So we significantly improved the default cover for most members, significantly reduced it for young members. In particular, reduced dramatically the death cover for people up to age 21. That was a strong element of the feedback. I actually don't want cover. I don't want insurance cover, and it's too damn hard to reduce it. So I'm paying money for cover that I don't want. Got two sons in that category, they're in my ear all the time about this, but it came through very strongly with the research we did with young members. Reducing the waiting period significantly, we introduced this life event concept, which is not for the first time in Australia, but I think for the first time in the group market, where much abbreviated underwriting for life events such as birth of a child, marriage, divorce, purchase of a home and so on. Improved the definitions for a number of categories, introduced TPD-only insurance. Again, not unique, but pretty rare. So you can just have TPD, no need to have death cover as well. And something that's been extremely well received by members, we've increased dramatically the AAL. So a member can, on joining the fund, receive up to $1.5 million death and TPD cover, up to $20,000 per month income protection insurance cover, subject, in the case of death and TPD cover, to a cap of $600,000 if that's 10 times income. So, the working with insurers was a very interesting process, and as I said, our experience validated our thought that it was a strong and competitive market. Most of the insurers we approached, and we had a dozen that we initially approached, all bar two of the ones we were hoping would respond positively did so. That gave us a very strong group. We then got that down to three. Everyone knows Cominsure and Tower, I won't mention the other, although it's received a little bit of publicity. Frankly, if any of those two had pulled out towards the end of the process, we would have been delighted to appoint the third. So you often, when you're tendering for services, you often say, gee, I hope they stick in because we don't want the second or third option. That was not the case here, which is a reflection of the strength of the Australian market, notwithstanding the views of some people in APRA to the contrary. So we had a, in our own minds at least, we had a pretty clear plan about what we wanted to do. We were very open with the insurers about that, and they bought into that, including things that required a step change in their thinking, in particular this issue about service. How can we make a quantum leap forward as regards the service that we provide to members? And they bought into that, and a number of them came up with ideas about how to achieve that. So it wasn't just us sitting on one side of the table dictating the terms. There was a lot of very constructive engagement. But interestingly, on the pricing side, we were getting conflicting signals in some instances from some of the insurers about the assumptions they had made in pricing compared to some of the publicly articulated views of other parts of their organisation about the economic period. So remember, this is through a pretty turbulent period in the global and Australian economy. There's a lot of discussion about what unemployment in particular was going to be like, that being a key variable here. And on more than one occasion, we had to say to more than one organisation, the views you're putting to us in these discussions are at odds with these views. And we would table media releases and newspaper clippings of eminent spokespeople from that organisation that had a more positive view of what the economic environment was like. And we didn't get the sense that there was any gamesmanship in these negotiations. They just weren't, not only were they not talking to each other as well as they might have, but they clearly weren't watching the media as well as they might have either, because we weren't doing any sort of espionage into what the views internally within the organisation were. This was all public and on the record. I think another really important element that helped us was the engagement of Jeff Humphreys. So one of the tasks we asked him to perform was to do some independent pricing before we started. And so a lot of the pricing that came back to us was significantly more adverse, shall we say, higher, than Jeff's pricing. So there's a problem, either Jeff had it wrong or almost all the insurers had it wrong. And interestingly, when we got to the end of the process, his pricing was validated really well. So notwithstanding that most of these insurers have long experience with industry funds, their actual insights into that experience was not as sharp as it might have been. This is true universally of the insurers we were dealing with. And the third last dot point comes to this point. In particular about income protection insurance, the experience with industry funds income protection insurance is not the same as, typically, the experience in corporate land, in that, perversely for some people, the experience is better amongst industry funds. The final point, and I'm not going to particularise here, but suffice to say that most, and I don't want you to leap to what might perhaps be the obvious conclusion, this is a big tender, well over $500 million worth of premiums over a 3-year period, so it's well worth winning. Not a good tender to lose. There's a lot of competition there, but and most of the organisations responded maturely. We've all lost tenders and we've all been disappointed, but some of the behaviour of some of the participants in bad-mouthing, not so much us, it's not a big issue, but in the context of this industry, bad-mouthing others was incredibly unprofessional and reflects, I think, very poorly on those involved. So, in summary, the preparatory work that we did, I think, set ourselves up for us having sufficient confidence that when the initial responses from insurers came back and it was at odds with our thoughts, we were confident that the work we'd done was frankly gave us a foundation for belief that we were on the right track and that they were not, and so we were able to engage and bring them to our conclusion. Can't force people to conclusion. I think we persuaded them on the merits to that. It was one of the great validations of the establishment of Australian Super, this process, the fact that our scale, obviously our experience, our claims experience was a material factor, but our scale was a really big factor because we had the buying power and we were able to have the suasion in the negotiations, which was backed by a scale, not because we were clever negotiators. You just bring a lot of oomph to the table. I'll deal with the last point, which relates in part to the comment I made on the previous slide. So there's been a bit of critical comment to the effect that we've got an uncommercial deal for Tower, to be candid about it. That's been the assertion or allegation in some quarters. We don't want an uncommercial deal because all it means is in 3 years' time we're going to be embarrassed when we go to members and have to jack up premiums substantially. So there's seen to be this adversarial relationship in some parts between a trustee and insurer. For me, it's that rather hackneyed cliche term, if you haven't got a win-win, you've got a problem. You might be the ostensible victor, but it's a Pyrrhic victory, because in 3 years' time, then the egg will be on your face. It doesn't matter about the insurer. So we're very confident that we've got a commercially robust outcome, not just for the fund, but also for Tower, because if they're in trouble, we're in trouble, and we don't want that. But the biggest issue for a fund of our character and our orientation is whether it delivers benefits for members. And the criteria that we measured success by at the outset, we were able to tick all of those. Price, better design, and in particular, much better service. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ian. Very informative way to kick off proceedings, and I certainly learned a few pointers out of that. So I'm sure that others in the audience will have as well. And I've already got a couple of people putting their hands up. Maybe Ray might like to kick off. Can I just ask before we start, Ray, if people could just mention their name at the start? I think we're being recorded. A million is nodding. We're being recorded. So if everyone can just state their name and then speak into the microphone along the way. Thank you.
Ray Murray from Sun Super. Ian, thank you very much for that. I have two questions. How did you wrestle with the simplicity versus cost subsidy issue amongst the various members? And the second question, a little bit more complex. An issue that's been challenging me is that as each fund maintains cover for people as they change employment, I've sort of developed a theory that people who change jobs have got more cover than they need now versus people who maybe stay with one job or stay with one fund. Did that come into your thinking at all and in your considerations at all?
Thanks, Ray. As regards to the latter point, no, it didn't, although labour mobility and the changes to design where there is an extended cover after the period of termination with an employer would lead naturally to that outcome, but it didn't factor in our thinking and wasn't put to us by insurers in any context. That wasn't really an element in our discussions. In relation to the first point, do you have a particular element of this vexed issue in mind?
Oh, no, just generally male, female, unit rates.
Yeah.
Age-based rates.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, we looked at, when we started, this was very much on our agenda, different rates for gender, smokers, non-smokers, all of that sort of business. When I look at our insurance guide PDS now, under the new arrangements, I'm still extremely disappointed with how long it is and how reader unfriendly it is, and that's having invested a lot of resources in trying to improve it in those senses. And that's consistent with the approach we took at the start, in that we wanted to make that, sorry, the outcome isn't, but our objective was to make that better as the final manifestation of a simpler product design. But of course, 2 and 2 doesn't equal 4 here. You improve design by providing extra options, and each time you do that, you just lose the trade-off. So I don't think you can get the perfect win-win here. You can have a brilliant default and modest tailoring or no tailoring, and of course you tick the simplicity box and you lose on the flexibility and cross-subsidy box, or you go the other way. We've made our design more complex, more sophisticated, to use some pejoratives in this context, or more tailored and provide greater flexibility for members, if you want to sort of sex it up a bit. But we've finally settled on what we think is as good a balance as we can get. In 3 years' time, we might change it one way or the other, but it involved a lot of discussion, and I think we've all wrestled with this issue. We haven't got it right, in particular because we can't explain it as simply as we should be able to. Transparency has its limits, I think. So, yeah, we will. We haven't quite decided how we'll do that, but you know, we're parading internally, at least, and in this forum, the fact that this is a significant change, and it'll be a terrific discipline on all parties involved to report that. So we do intend to do that more, and I've sort of pushed this internally more to ensure that we take every endeavour we can, or make every endeavour we can, to provide the improved service that we've asserted. So we haven't started this process yet, so I'm pretty bullish that we'll achieve it, but talk is pretty cheap, and the sort of thing you're talking about, that is reporting the results, is a great discipline, I think, on those involved to deliver the results. Take-up is interesting, because, as I said before, more than 90% of members today have the default level of cover. Just over 1% have opted to have no cover, so this is under the previous regime, if you like. And about 5% have expanded their cover. It's not necessarily... We don't have any ambition out of this to drive that 90% or just over 90% figure down to 80 or 70 or 60 or whatever. That's not an objective. It would be an objective in a perfect world of fully informed, rational consumers. And we don't have fully informed, rational consumers in our fund. Well, not 1.5 million of them anyway. Sorry, with all due respect to those members here. So we've got about 900,000 people who are covered by this insurance offer. We know that most of them, the majority of them, are not in a position to make an informed decision on this. They don't have the interest or the knowledge or whatever. So that's why the default offering is so important. That said, we wouldn't have expanded the design and made the options we think, more attractive if we didn't regard those who want to make the choice as important in our consideration. So to get to your question, as of today, we've had about 3% of members take up other than the default setting, but the special offer which we have in the market doesn't conclude until, I think it is the 28th of May. So if events run true to form for the last three special offers we have, we'd expect that that number will more, whatever the number is as the last week starts, it will double in that last week. So might be 5 or 6, maybe 7%, something like that. But we made it clear to the team it's not a mark of failure if the non-default people don't skyrocket, because that's just not a realistic outcome for our membership.
Hi, it's Kevin Assault from Russell. One question on design, one on service. Design, did Australian Super specify the design in going to the insurers, or was it a collaborative thing? And secondly, on service, you comment on the lamentable service. If I remember the number on TBD, claims processing was 170 days. If you had your best optimal situation, would you like to have TBD claims settled in 30 days?
Okay. The design was, I'd say, 95% determined by the fund, and there was some interaction with insurers along the way, but it was fundamentally the fund that determined the design. And the second question, there are two elements to it. The first is those figures, as I said, didn't deal with... the clock only started ticking when all the documentation was in. The biggest changes we will make is to have that process, which can take months and months and months, as we all know, be much truncated. So we will have members make a phone call, so this tele-lodgement process that I spoke of. They will. The process that we have in mind is the members will ring a number, be told in that conversation what material they are required to have, and an appointment time will be made for them to ring back. And usually it will be less than a week, the material they will require to obtain. That second phone call should be, in most cases, the overwhelming majority of cases, will be the last conversation they need to have as part of the claims process with the administrator/insurer. That's where most of the changes are going to be made. From the receipt of the material, we're still working on what that precise service standard is going to be, but it will be a much reduced one. But the real savings aren't even reflected on that table, because you'll recall there was simply a note up there to the effect that it didn't reflect the preparatory work, for want of a better term. All of that will be much reduced.
the one area that I'm not informed sufficiently, I think, and I think the major problem is people are not being informed, is that of disability and what is required when people are disabled. And there's big debate within the medical fraternity that's basically the orientation of how that can be best achieved. You mentioned the gaps, the gap being in the question of rehabilitation. And I wanted to just talk a little bit more about where the gaps were and what you were going to do about it.
So which gaps are these?
In rehabilitation.
Oh, rehabilitation. Yeah. The main issue for rehabilitation, there were two elements. One, the research amongst members, not surprisingly, suggested they were very keen on proactive rehabilitation. And the TPD model doesn't really lend itself to that. Once a claim has been made, there's no incentive for any external party to rehabilitate the member, get them back into the workforce. So it's income protection insurance, the injection of income protection insurance into our default arrangements, which have put a focus on that issue for us. So the incentive for the insurer, the commercial incentive for the insurer, and the incentive from the trustee as part of discharging its trustee responsibilities to try and get the member back to work. So that's where the rehabilitation comes in. It wasn't part of our thinking, frankly, not part of our offering, if you like, at all, but it's very much part of the income protection insurance management of people who have made and had a claim accepted.
Ian, Ron and Mitch, just see. How far, I'm just taking into account the note, the earlier slide of market feedback where I was saying a large majority of people would have been keen to have a mix of a lump sum and pension payment for TPD. How far, if at all, did you go down this path of looking at a combination lump sum and drip fee?
Yeah, well, we looked at two concepts here. One was a bucket approach where you might have a total insurance benefit of, say, $100, and you could draw it down depending on your circumstances. If you died tomorrow, then your beneficiaries would get $100. But if you were disabled tomorrow then and you had an income over a period that equated to $40, you still had $60, for example. That was one form of this combination we spoke of. We didn't pursue that. There was some strong proponents for that model amongst our internal team, but we didn't ultimately settle on that. So the combination that we settled on was a means whereby a person can receive a TPD payment and an income protection insurance for the one instance. So that's the combination we spoke of. But you spoke about feedback. Notwithstanding that there was strong appetite for increased payments from members, it was still a bit of a shock to some of them to see that we were proposing to increase the default deductions to the extent that we were. And we've had a number of members ring the call centre to express their, shall we say, disquiet about that. So it's not been universally endorsed by 900,000 people, albeit I just say that sort of more out of sort of being candid about it. The proportions involved are, or the percentage involved, are minuscule, but there are some people who are not happy about it, and of course they've got the option to opt out.
First of all, with your new GSC benefit, do you have issues around awareness amongst your membership that they've got that new benefit? And the second question, you have a very, very high AL, amongst the highest in the industry. Do you have concerns that you will get people who are not amongst your normal membership who will take advantage of that? Do you have safeguards to monitor that?
Hmm. Okay, so what was the GSC issue you were raising?
Awareness.
Do you mean in the context of will they make claims given they've got the cover? Yeah. Will they know? Well, to be honest, not all of them will know, just as not all of them know now the extent of insurance coverage they have. And that's a responsibility of the trustee to ensure that that level of knowledge is as widespread as possible. But will they all know? No, they won't. We send material out and we're extremely proud of what we've done here. So we want people to understand the benefits they have and make use of them when they're eligible to do that. So we're doing as much as we can, but will we be 100% successful? Frankly, no, but it won't be through lack of trying. The second point was AALs. We're conscious that they're very high, and we're conscious that that opens the door to abuse, issues of selection and so on. Our overall position on this was, well, first of all of the insurers accepted this. There was no arm twisting required, and there was universal acceptance of that proposal, which we put on the table. So that's quite telling, I think. I think the issue with us is that with such a large population and such a diverse population that I think what has been a typically conservative pricing mindset in this industry has factored in a lot of selection issues. I think it's been over factored in, to be honest. So we reserve the right, of course, to change those arrangements in the event that we see material problems emerging from them, but none of the insurers, and it's the trustee view as well, see that as likely. I think one of the reasons it's not likely to be a major problem is that we've seen evidence of this already in the short period of time between now and when these announcements were made. I think a lot of the things that we were very proud to have made some breakthroughs on will increasingly be, if not norms and standards in the industry, more commonly seen through the industry. So I think we'll see, on the back of this policy, AAL substantially ramp up across the board.
Hi, my name is Fintan Thornton. I'm from Russell. I'm actually there. My question is kind of a bit hypothetical, but as we see the population of Australia growing, and it's expected to grow and double to about 36 million, say, do you see any scope for the industry to find the time together and creating their own insurance company and using that in the future, or is it something that you actually looked at as part of this process?
We're conscious that that's a model that's open to us. We're a pretty big fund in our own right. That premium income that I spoke of is a large amount of money. You combine that with some other funds, you're looking at a substantial potential size in the market. But it's not something we're looking at the moment. We wouldn't have changed insurers and all the angst that involves if we were looking at doing something like that in the near term. And I only use qualifications like that because who knows what might happen, but it's not something that we're planning for.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
You mentioned to do with the service issue, the diversity of your membership.
Mm.
In terms of things like the telephone claims process, is that the only option? I'm just thinking you've got huge language differences, I've seen in terms of language skills, different demographics, so do you use social media, do you what else are you looking at in terms of the delivery mechanism for some of this?
We do have all of the communication issues associated with a diverse membership, including language issues, and they're factors at play today. Leaving aside insurance, we have people of different literacy and numeracy skills, different languages that contact the call centre now, and so we have a large number of different language capacities already online in the already available in the contact centre. And for unusual languages, we get an interpreter, ask a person to ring back, and we'll have an interpreter there, and so on. So all this is another product offering that has to be addressed in the broader context of communication. So we're not doing anything specifically in relation to this insurance offering as regard the matter you raised, Meredith, except this. Aside from the tele-lodgement arrangement, we are introducing online tools. So aside from applications being addressed online, we'll have underwriting tools online too. Now, that might or might not work, depending on the person's communication skills and so on, but it's another element. And so we do see the tele-lodgement and the greater use of online tools, both for applying to adjust cover and for underwriting purposes, to be an increasingly used tool as this contract unfolds and certainly beyond that.
From RGA.
Can I ask a question slightly off the insurance line? Perhaps for the last 10 years, the difference between mutual funds and mutual funds have been a commission and a non-profit. In 10 years' time, I think that will probably be the case. What do you see in the future as being the main differentiator between mutual fund movements and retail funds?
I think one thing that won't change, almost by definition, so long as industry funds remain true to label, is commercial funds, retail funds will have another constituency that profit for member funds don't have, and that is shareholders, obviously. But it won't be enough for profit for member funds to assert that as a differentiator, because if I'm a member, frankly, I don't care too much about your philosophical orientation. I'm interested in how it manifests itself for the benefits that are provided to me. So the Compare the Pair campaign, I think, was very effective in articulating a particular difference, and I think there have been a number of changes, not just the proposed ban on commissions, but I think over the last decade or so you've seen product convergence. So you've seen industry funds, and today's an example of it, industry funds developing a more sophisticated range of products, and you've seen a number of the retail funds or commercial funds moving down the product spectrum, keeping some sophisticated products, but BT Super for Life is sort of the archetypal example of that. AMP has an industry fund lookalike in purported cost terms. The big issue for us, as I said, won't be the philosophical orientation. It will be whether we can continue to deliver better outcomes for members. And I think we certainly should be able to. If we don't, it's a failure of execution. It's not a failure of model. Because, of course, we don't have this other constituency of shareholders. So the stream that's heading to shareholders in the commercial world should be being diverted to members in the profit-for-member world. So, as I said, the model, I think, is superior from a member point of view, subject to satisfactory execution and subject to one other thing, which is a less tangible but at least as big a threat to that occurring, that is the ongoing success of industry funds, and that is funds becoming so big and so remote and so suffering from hubris that they lose sight of what their real differential is, and such that it moves from an actual benefit to an ostensible benefit that doesn't really reflect itself for members. And I don't see any sign of that at the moment, but I dare say some of the organisations that have mutualised in the last 20 years didn't see that shortly before that occurred either. So that's an ever-present issue for a mutual organisation that's running head-to-head in the commercial world.
Thanks, Ian. Unfortunately, time has beaten us a little bit. I'm sure we could have gone on for another hour or two. I certainly found your presentation and candid responses to everybody's questions very, very valuable. So thank you very much on behalf of all of us here. If I could just ask everybody to thank Ian in the usual way.